Welcome back to the program. Tuesday night, the president talked a great deal about the future, about what the world might look like for the next generation. For most of us, speculating about the future is just that, idle speculation based on opinion and intuition. For our guest today, the future is his reality. George Friedman spends his life thinking about the future. His previous book, The Next 100 Years, took us on a 30,000-foot view of the coming century. Now, in his new book, The Next Decade, he comes down to earth to look at what's changing on the ground as he views the future within our grasp. George Friedman is the founder and CEO of Stratafor, the world's leading publisher of global geopolitical intelligence, and the author of the new book, The Next Decade. George Friedman, thanks so much for joining us. Great to have you here. When you talk about geopolitical forecasting, talk a little bit, first of all, about what goes into that process.
Well, the heart of it is excluding all those things that are impossible. It's about constraints. It assumes that presidents, for example, don't really have nearly as many choices in what they're going to do as they might expect or as the public expects. They're not sitting with a blank piece of paper. They're sitting with the real world. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the classic cases has been Obama's foreign policy. There's no question that Obama wanted a dramatically different foreign policy than George Bush had. I mean, he really did. And when he came into office, he discovered that to a very great extent that wasn't an option, and that he shared a great deal of policies with Bush. And when we look back on Bush, we begin to think about just how much choice did he have in what he was going to do. So geopolitics is really about not thinking about presidents as people and as powerful men, thinking about presidents as the pawns of history, doing what has to be done.
But oftentimes there are those presidents or those times that allow for kind of singular decisions which really do have an opportunity, do have a chance to shift things at least a little bit off their axis.
I think that's true, but I think the most successful presidents are the ones who recognize what the possibilities are and are aware of what is impossible and don't let their desires and moral constraints get in the way of that. And I think of Abraham Lincoln, who had a wonderful line. He said, "I hope God is on our side, but I must have Kentucky." And, you know, what that really meant was that if he was going to win this war, he was going to have an alliance with a slave-owning state, and he was going to have to like it. And I think his ability to change history consisted of the fact that he unsentimentally recognized that sort of thing.
One of the things that you talk about with respect to this is this seeming contradiction, but not really, between kind of deep moral intentions on the one hand and a sense of ruthless pragmatism on the other.
Well, power without morality is thuggishness. But morality without power is kind of self-indulgence. It's very easy to have moral principles. It's infinitely more difficult to have moral principles and act on them, because you discover that sometimes you have to go in a very different direction. I think of FDR, who hated fascism with a passion, and in order to defeat it, made an alliance with Joseph Stalin, a homicidal maniac. To be moral and to exercise power requires a level of subtlety and sophistication that most of us, I think, don't want to have, let alone have. But certainly my view is, how can you be moral if you don't have power?
And to the extent that the world is more complex, arguably, more interconnected, more sensitive today, how has this changed in terms of ascertaining these movements on the chessboard?
I'm not sure that Barack Obama actually faces a more complex world than FDR or Ronald Reagan or Abraham Lincoln. I think one of the things that has been constant in human history back to the Greeks and Thucydides is the complexity of the relationship between morality and power, and the complexity of the chessboard. In many ways, Obama has an easier problem than FDR did. But I will say that the requirements of a president remain the same, which is, on the one hand, to have a deep moral core, and on the other hand, a ruthless understanding that to achieve moral things is not a straight line.
The other question, I suppose, is how much, and this goes back to a point you made earlier, how much any president is capable of really doing within today's framework?
My feeling is that presidents can screw things up. And avoiding that is about the best thing a president can do. And sometimes you can have, as you put it, as we talked about it for a second ago, the brilliant coup. But, you know, presidents are just one men. They live in the structure of, firstly, an institution that made them, and within the reality of the American public. I mean, the American public places tremendous constraints on the president. The American public demands frequently contradictory things. The American public demands to be led and then doesn't want to follow. The president is faced, between his bureaucracy, the world, and a fickle public, with an extraordinarily difficult task. And most of them don't do very well at it.
And to what extent does it matter the degree to which that American public, for example, is paying attention to issues of foreign policy, the degree to which the country is focused on them, and whether that gives it, at various times, a president more or less ability to maneuver?
Well, the president has the most ability to maneuver on subjects that the public isn't paying attention
mm-hmm.
to. Because when the public pays attention to a foreign policy issue, they frequently want to have their cake and eat it too. I remember the 9/11 commission coming out saying, you know, why didn't we have better intelligence on Al-Qaeda? And then many of the same people who spoke on that subject of failure of the Bush administration, opposing anything that intrudes on American civil liberties. The fact of the matter is, to get better intelligence, you have to intrude. If you're going to intrude, you're going to violate civil liberties. There are decisions to be made. And one of the things I argue in the book is that our problem is not our politicians. Our problem is ourselves. We lack a sophisticated understanding of the trade-offs we have to make. We don't want to make trade-offs, whether it is in financing our government or in carrying out foreign policy. And one of our great joys is, rather than taking responsibility for the mistakes we, as the public, make, we use our politicians as kind of scapegoats. You did what we told you to do. How could you have been so stupid?
And to what extent, though, does that hamstring us in trying to do what needs to be done in the complex world we live in today?
Well, that is one of the great difficulties of the Republic. The United States became what I call an empire in 1991. In 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed. For the first time, there was no European global power. They were all just minor regional powers, and the United States kind of was the last man standing in a bar fight. The American public still hasn't come to terms with what happened. They still fantasize about a world where, well, the Cold War is over, we don't have to deal with these things. Or one day the war on terror will be over and then we won't have to deal with these things. They haven't accommodated themselves to the idea that a country that produces 25% of the world's wealth every year, controls all the oceans, isn't going to go back to the fantasy world in which the United States can leave the world and not be involved. And therefore, the politicians haven't developed methods and processes whereby they can manage American power without constantly trampling around and crashing into things.
Because we seem to only want to look at it in a very binary sense. Either, you know, we're in charge or we're not, but the subtlety and nuance is what seems to get lost.
Well, because the subtlety and nuances are distasteful. The subtlety and nuances requires a degree of dishonesty with others. That means that the president has to be dishonest with the American public as well. There is a deep distrust in the American system of great state power. We were founded both as an anti-imperial power, and we were founded as a country that distrusts the government. So we wind up in this wild situation where the United States has enormous global power, not just influence, not exercising it is the same thing as exercising it. The public does not trust the government. The government tries to do things that have to be done behind the public's back. And this is the single greatest threat in the next decade to the republic. The real problem of empire is not only that it's distasteful to the American public, but the demands of the American public and the realities of the world are grinding against each other. And the state is kind of filling up the vacuum created by the public and usurping their powers.
And to the extent that economics plays arguably a larger and larger role in how all these issues play out globally, talk about that.
Well, I mean, we talk about globalization. That's certainly the case. There's a great deal of international trade. For the United States, that means that if it changes its regulations on the import of bananas, countries in Latin America can be plunged into depression without us even realizing that it's happened. When you control 25% of the world's economy, every decision made by a Target or a Walmart can have devastating effects on cities and villages around the world. We become enormously powerful. But it also means that the more international trade there is, the more that trade will go in the oceans. And the power that controls all the oceans, the United States, is in a terrifically powerful position, or at least is feared by everyone. So you wind up with a situation where the economic and the military are continually interacting, and they have to. For China, the great dread is the United States is going to use its naval power to, at one point, put a blockade on China. The United States certainly has the power to do that. It doesn't have the intent. And the Chinese really don't trust American intent. And so these economic frictions turn into potential military frictions. And without a very subtle leadership managing these, great damage can be done.
I mean, you see it now in all the concern about foreign policy issues that are really coming out of meetings, for example, in Davos now, where that used to focus on just economic issues. It now has broader implications.
Well, the 1990s, when Davos began, was a fantasy world. The Soviet Union collapsed. And like the period after World War II, World War I, or the Napoleonic Wars, there was this kind of feeling that that was the war to end all wars. And the 1990s were that period in which everybody could imagine that geopolitics were finished, and the only really important thing was business. And that's where Davos, the World Economic Forum, began. 9/11 transformed that world. It reminded us that the history wasn't ended, that the classical problems of war and economics are intertwined, and life goes on. And I think one of the basic problems of the United States is it hasn't come to terms with this reality. I mean, you have to remember, the United States has been the world's dominant power only since 1991. The first half of the century, it was a marginal power. The second half of the century was involved in a dreadful Cold War that seemed sometimes about to become a nuclear war where the Soviets were ahead. And I think many Americans don't understand what happened in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed, which was that we were thrust in a world that had never existed before, where North America was the center of the international system. And we have no sense of perspective. For Americans, having been in this only 20 years, every problem we have is the end of the world. The attack at 9/11 was the end of the world. The economic crisis was the end of the world. We don't benchmark very well. And we wind up in situations where we're constantly overcommitting because we panic. I have friends, you know, who are very wise now about 9/11, but I remember them sitting with them on September 12th. They were quite frightened. So was I. As I like to put it, anybody who wasn't frightened after 9/11 was not in touch with reality. But at the same time, it is the job of this government and the public to maintain a sense of perspective, and that's something we don't have.
What is the nexus between understanding the U.S.'s role as an empire, as you talk about, on the one hand, and on the other, kind of the promotion of a democratic agenda throughout the world?
Well, I mean, there's a real problem between the two things. Mm-hmm. It is possible to be an empire, as the Romans were and the British were, and fairly well respect the way that other people work. You know, we talk about multiculturalism, and then we say, yes, we're multicultural, but you should treat women the way we do, elect your leaders the way we do, and respect human rights the way we think of human rights. And this is something that you can find on the right, and you can find equally on the left. It goes across the spectrum. That's a bridge too far in international relations. It is one thing to manage the situation to get other countries to do what you want them to do in your interest. But we go beyond that. We want them to become like us. And that's something we really can't do. And I really want to emphasize this. When a human rights group demands that Saudi Arabia be more democratic, treat women differently, what they're doing is attacking the culture of Saudi Arabia. Now, my problem is not that they're attacking the culture of Saudi Arabia. I don't particularly admire it myself. It's that they're demanding things that the other side isn't going to do and we don't have the power to impose. So to have an empire, you have to be like the Romans, quite tolerant.
And as we look out at the next 10 years, within that time frame, how much really can change given the limitation of the global landscape we've been talking about?
Well, in the next 10 years, there's some specific things that have to be addressed. But the basic architecture of the world is set for quite a while.
Uh-huh.
The United States is the preeminent power. Other countries don't like that. They feel uncomfortable. The United States can't be ignored, and it can't be managed. What can change is the degree of subtlety with which we manage our power, and, of course, managing certain specific issues, such as, for example, Iran. And managing it more subtly than we do. I mean, the problem of Iran is not that it's going to be a nuclear power. I doubt that it will be. I always have. It is that it's by far the largest conventional military force in the region. If the United States withdraws from Iraq, Iran will dominate Iraq. And it will also have tremendous influence, power, and intimidation on the Arabian Peninsula, where the oil is stored, if you will. How do we deal with Iran? How do we deal with, on the one hand, the imperative to leave Iraq, on the other hand, the desire not to have them dominate the region? In other words, how do we rebuild the balance of power that we lost in 2003? Now, these are subtle, complex issues that can't be contained in a decision paper, if you will. What you really have to think about is, on the one hand, how do you intimidate the Iranians? On the other hand, how do you talk to the Iranians? And there will be a great deal of duplicity involved in that. In order for that to happen, we have to trust the government. No one was more duplicitous than FDR,
mm-hmm.
who publicly stated that the United States was not going to get into a foreign war. When he not only knew that he was going to get into a foreign war, he was planning it. He lied because the American public wasn't capable of hearing the truth. He knew what a threat Hitler was, and he understood that there was something defective in democracy. And what was defective in democracy was that in a democracy, people frequently vote for the things they wish were true rather than for the things that are true. Roosevelt was duplicitous. In the end, we not only forgave him, we, in many cases, admired him for the things he did. But interestingly, there are very few books about the period that citizens wrote that said, 1938, boy, was I stupid. where we're going to go is dealing with specific problems like Iran, with a government that hopefully has enough cunning to manage it, and the public that understands that that cunning is necessary. And that's going to be the challenge.
And it is encouraging on some levels that when you read, for example, all of the WikiLeaks cables, that there is a level of nuance and subtlety among diplomats and the people that are doing this work.
Indeed. And knowing these people, these are very bright people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this, you know, nonsense about, you know, American diplomats and the CIA being stupid, bumbling fools. They're not. I mean, we may draw comfort from the idea they're incompetent, but they're not. But they're severely limited on what they can do by what the public will tolerate and permit. They understand what the world's about. But WikiLeaks is a perfect example. I mean, Assange is a strange man, and I don't know what he really believes.
Right.
But if you really genuinely believe that the problem of the Bush administration was that it's resorted to force instead of resorting to diplomacy, then you have to be appalled at the WikiLeaks. You cannot engage in bargaining when the other side knows what you're thinking. I mean, you can't walk into a car dealership to buy a car and say, well, let me be honest. I'm going to buy this car at any price. Now let's bargain. And what Assange seems to be saying is that he condemns the United States for being militarily aggressive, and then he attacks the foundations of diplomacy, which is obviously secrecy. And this is the sort of thing that the public here and in Europe strike me as extraordinarily immature, particularly the Europeans, who are the champions of diplomacy and certainly have a history that understand that diplomats don't show all their cards, celebrating the fact that the fairly minor discussions with diplomats, among diplomats, as they describe their host governments, is made public, thereby making diplomacy impossible and increasing the likelihood of war.
Yeah. You wonder how much of that reaction, and particularly among European leaders, was for public consumption as opposed to what they really thought about it.
Well, the European public is bitterly resentful of the United States and thinks that the United States should follow the example of European diplomacy. And certainly, I hope that the American politicians learn to be like European diplomats in 1914 and 1939, because it is difficult to imagine a more viciously incompetent group of people than European diplomats in the 20th century. It always strikes me as odd when I go to Europe, and I do a great deal, that they're constantly lecturing the United States. Can you imagine the world if the Europeans had nuclear weapons in 1914? It is the great good fortune that the nuclear weapons are in the hands of the Soviet Union and the United States, two countries that were far more sophisticated than the Europeans, and carefully worked to avoid what seemed inevitable, nuclear war. So the Europeans do this because they're bitterly jealous of what we were, what we are, and nostalgic about what they were. And that's shared between the politicians and the public. But it's the American public which is interesting, particularly the left, which has argued that the United States must engage in diplomacy and also celebrated the WikiLeaks. I don't know how you do that. And these are the kinds of things that really make it difficult to manage an empire.
One of the things you talk about in the next decade are some of the, particularly with respect to Europe, some of the shifting relationships that we're going to see, the additional strain on the European Union, perhaps more of a relationship between Germany and Russia, the importance of Poland. Talk a little about that.
Well, the European Union was a very strange idea. And it was a strange idea this way. Most of the peripheral countries in Europe are developing countries, not third world countries, but in developing. And developing countries normally export more than they import, taking advantage of their wage, of their lower wages, and building their economy that way. At the heart of the European Union, however, is Germany, the world's second largest exporter, which has flooded these countries with German goods and has created negative balances of trade. All of this was okay in the 20 years after the EU was created, after the Maastricht Treaty, until you had your first major financial crisis. And then all of these countries staggered under the blow because of the fact they hadn't developed properly and had spent so much money buying German goods. The Germans then turned around and said, quite reasonably if I were a German, I don't want to save the Greeks. Why should we? Well, the government did. But the tolerance of the German elite, of the German public for many more bailouts is limited. And at the same time, as an Irish person told me about three months ago, my God, we spent 100 years getting rid of the British, and now we're going to get Brussels in here. So the questions of national sovereignty, the questions of the structural rationality of the EU, all of these things come to a head. In the meantime, Germany is developing a second relationship, a very important one, with Russia. Germany is dependent on Russian natural gas for functioning. Germany also has a demographic crisis, and it doesn't want to have any more Turkish immigrants. And so they, if they can't bring in more people, they have to move their factories to where labor is. Russia also has a demographic problem. But interestingly, even though it has a declining population, it still has a lot of people who are underemployed and unemployed. And that makes it possible to move factories to Russia. They also, Russians need technology. The Germans have it. This is a very good symbiotic relationship. They share one other thing in common. Both of them want insulation from the United States. Both of them see the United States as much too strong, much too large, and would want to create a balance to it. So we're seeing a deepening German-Russian relationship. And, of course, caught between them, as always, is Poland, who is now seeing its worst nightmare, its good friend the Russians and its good friend the Germans getting friendly again.
Talk a little about the impact that this has on U.S. foreign policy, how we need to respond to that.
Well, we are responding to it by what I call ballistic missile defense diplomacy. We're placing ballistic missile defense systems or parts of systems throughout the region from Turkey up to Poland. And, of course, where you place ballistic missile defense systems, you have to put forces to defend them. You have to bring in contractors. You can really jumpstart the regional economy. I always use the example of South Korea, which in 1950 was a nation of rice farmers, and by year 2000 was producing the cars we drive and the TVs we watch. Why did that happen? How did South Korea do that? Well, it had a special relationship with the United States, access to the American markets, access to American capital, and was encouraged to do the technology transfers and so on. We needed South Korea to be strong. Poland starts on a much higher level than South Korea did. And so what happens here is the United States moves not by sending massive amounts of troops, but by using economic and political and military elements very subtly to strengthen Poland, to strengthen the rest of Eastern Europe. And this is not done with great signings and celebrations and things like that. It's done fairly quietly. George Bush was doing it. Obama came in and then for a while seemed to be reversing that policy because he didn't want to offend either the Germans or the Russians. He discovered that the Germans and the Russians would be offended regardless of who's president. Whether or not they were offended, they had different interests, and he's resumed it. So what's interesting in seeing what's happened is the extent to which Obama came in with a very different set of intentions in that region, believed profoundly that the reason for the friction between the United States and Germany, for example, was Bush's unwillingness to consult them, discovered that the reason for the friction goes far deeper than that, and the fact that it really does involve personalities at all, or policies, and has slowly been moving in the direction that Bush did. It's really a fascinating thing to watch the manner in which Obama's intentions shift and the way his practice shifts. And a lot of people said that he sold out. No, he's just discovered the same reality Bush was living in.
And as we turn our attention to Asia, one of the things you talk about in the next decade is China sort of evolving into a more mature economy?
Well, sure. After 30 years, you grow up. China is a paradox. The first thing to understand is how poor China is. According to Chinese government statistics, 600 million of the 1.3 billion Chinese live in households earning less than $3 a day. That's mother, father, children, everybody. 440 million live in households earning between $3 and $6 a day. which means that of a billion Chinese, 1.3 billion Chinese, over a billion live in sub-Saharan African poverty. There's this other China that we think of as China that has about 60 million people in it, so it has an average income, a family of 20,000 a year. That's a very large country, but it's less than 5% of China. And they can't sell their goods to people earning $3 a day. That's not good. They're not buying iPods. And so they are hostages to the United States and Europe where they sell their goods. The United States and Europe are both in more subdued economic times. Their appetite for Chinese goods has declined. And as the appetite for goods declined, wages have risen in China. So China is no longer quite as competitive as once was. It's cheaper to produce goods in Mexico today than it is in China. And China is squeezed on the one side by inflation and the other side by the terror of unemployment. And so the Chinese government encourages lending practices that take businesses that really should go out of business, they're losing money, lends them money to cover bad loans in an ever-increasing cycle. And this is pretty much what happened with Japan in 1990. And if you remember Japan in 1990, it was a time when they bought Pebble Beach,
right,
when they bought Rockefeller Center. And the thing that had to be remembered is, if the Japanese economy were as good as everybody was saying, why were they buying these things instead of investing in Japan? Because they knew what was happening. We see the same thing happening with China. The Chinese are making massive overseas investments, some of them not particularly rational, to which the question is, if China is as exciting a place to be as everyone says, why are the Chinese investing overseas so heavily? And again, it's because the Chinese know something. They're not stupid. But their real fear is that unemployment will lead to social unrest, and therefore they are increasing their repression and their nationalism. So it's not that China will collapse. It's not that China will disappear. It is simply that just as Japan and South Korea at a certain point changed the way they behaved, the Chinese are not going to do that. But the problem is that 60 million are changing the way they behave. I'm not sure what it does to the real China.
And Japan still remains a kind of enigma, going its own way in the region.
Well, they are an economy, second or third largest by pennies in the world. They've done that for 20 years. They've achieved what they wanted. They were less interested in growth than they were in full employment. And they've maintained full employment throughout the last 20 years. And that was a trade-off they made. And American investors can't understand that because obviously American investors prefer growth. And the Japanese have been quite content not to grow very fast, if at all. The Japanese are in a similar situation to what China is entering, with one tremendous advantage. They don't have a billion impoverished people. They're a relatively homogeneous society. So I see Japan and Asia reemerging as the major power, as it was until 1990. Yeah. And, you know, these things rotate. What goes up always comes down.
George Friedman, his book is The Next Decade. George, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
I enjoyed this very much.
Thank you.